I want to share with you a brief Old Testament lesson from the 33rd chapter of Genesis. This is the tail end of the story of Jacob and Esau. Now Jacob looked up and saw Esau coming and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids with their children in front, then Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He himself went on ahead of them, bowing himself to the ground seven times until he came near his brother. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. This is the word of God for us, people of God. Thanks be to God. It is surprising in many ways that Jacob is the source of the name of God's chosen people, the people with whom God chose to make an everlasting covenant. He is associated with the name that is given the promised land, Israel. Jacob received this name after wrestling with God through the night. Why are God's people not called the Evites or the Adamites? Why was the covenant not made with a people called the Abrahamites or the Sarahians or maybe the Noahites? Why is the promised land not called the United States of Moses? Instead, it is Israel. Now, to be fair, Jacob gets the nod for plenty of valid reasons. He was the father of the 12 patriarchs, after whom the 12 tribes would take their name. He was granted multiple visions and dreams and revelations from God. He was a dogged dealer. He was a shrewd businessman, and he was an indefatigable wrestler, literally and metaphorically speaking. Yet I wonder if perhaps part of the reason that we call God's people after him is this moment. In a most pronounced way, Jacob stands out from his predecessors as the one who experiences explicit, radical forgiveness. Jacob's, Israel's, great stature is dependent in part upon the humbling gift of being forgiven. Now, the story of Jacob begins with incredible tension. His parents, Isaac and Rebekah, had been unable to have children, and so finally, when Rebekah is able to get pregnant, she receives an abundance, twins. The boys wrestle in utero, so much so that Rebekah prays to God, saying, if it has to be this way, then why do I live? Esau is delivered first, but as he emerges, there is a hand on his heel. Jacob, Israel. As the boys grow up, one day Esau goes out hunting, and he comes back empty-handed and empty-bellied. And so he sees his brother Jacob making a red lentil stew, and he walks up to him and he says, "Give me some of that." And Jacob won't just give it to him. Instead, he bargains. First, he says, "Sell me your birthright." Esau is so overwhelmed with his hunger that he makes a bad deal. Then the tension boils over. Genesis 27 sets it up like this. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called his elder son Esau and said to him, "My son." And Esau answered, "Here I am." And he said, "See, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, your bow, and go to the field and hunt game for me. Then prepare for me savory food, such as I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may bless you before I die." Rebekah overhears this request, and soon she and Jacob are working overtime to intercept the blessing. Jacob slaughters two goats, and Rebekah makes a stew, and together they cover Jacob's hands and his neck with the skins from the goats so that he might seem as hirsute as Esau, and then they clothe him in Esau's finest attire. Fortunately for Jacob, at this point, the Ten Commandments have not yet been written down, because he manages to violate most of them in one scene. honor thy father. Do not covet. Thou shalt not steal. The kicker, though, is when he uses the Lord's name in vain. Because when Isaac questions him, how is it that you possibly could have made things come together so quickly? Jacob responds without hesitation, because the Lord your God has granted me success. After some hesitation, Isaac buys it and then bestows a great blessing upon Jacob. As Jacob slips out, in comes Esau, and the scene is absolutely heartbreaking. Esau asks Isaac to sit up and to eat and to share that promised blessing. But Isaac says, "Who are you?" Esau realizes what happens, and he's overwhelmed with anguish, with fury, and he begs Isaac once, twice, three times, "Is there not still a blessing?" And finally, Isaac gives him a blessing, but it's half blessing, half curse, and looks pitiful in comparison to what Jacob had stolen. At the hands of his own brother, Esau's moment of triumph becomes a moment of desolation as his own father says, "Who are you?" When you think about it, it is incredible that the writers of the Bible didn't clean this story up. Couldn't you have just skipped it, left it out? Or couldn't you have just reframed it slightly, said, "Hey, it was a competition and Jacob won out"? Why lay this story out, lay the fact out that Jacob, Israel, the namesake of God's covenant people and the promised land, stole his brother's blessing with deception and dishonesty? Jacob, Israel, lends his name to the covenant people because sin, in part, is part of who we are. And it is humbling, but also necessary to include sin in our story. Like Jacob, we have made mistakes. Like Jacob, we have done wrong. Like Jacob, we have hurt those we purport to love. Not surprisingly, Esau fumes. He declares, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching, then I will kill my brother Jacob." In the face of Esau's murderous fury, Rebekah arranges for Jacob to go away, to go to her brother's people across the river Euphrates. Like Adam and Eve heading out of Eden after that original sin, Jacob's sin leads to exile, leads him away from home. At its most fundamental level, isn't this the nature of sin? Sin leads us away from home. Sin leads us away from our relationships. Sin leads us away from our true selves, away from who we are supposed to be. Like Jacob, our sin means exile. Now, when Jacob gets near Rebekah's homeland, he spots some flocks and shepherds waiting at a well, and then a young woman, whose name is Rachel, leads his uncle Laban's flock to that well, and Jacob is immediately smitten. He single-handedly removes the boulder covering over the well and waters her flock, which is basically equivalent in that day of culture to us when a young man hands a woman a dozen roses. Then he follows her home, and he asks Laban for her hand in marriage. Now, it has become time for the trickster to be tricked. Just as Jacob struck a hard bargain with Esau and traded stew for his birthright, so Laban strikes a hard bargain with Jacob and asked to trade 7 years of hard service for his daughter's hand in marriage. Just as Jacob deceived both Isaac and Esau by trickery to steal that blessing, so Laban tricks Jacob into marrying his older daughter, Leah. before he can marry Rachel, and then extends that time of service by a matter of decades. With the years of deception and trickery at the hands of Laban, Jacob gets Jacobed. Tricked, he knows the burn of his own trickery. Deceived, Jacob now sees his own deception. In the discomfort of exile, he starts to see well. In the discomfort of exile, we start to see well. We start to remember. We remember the comforts of home. We remember who we are called to be. We remember our true selves. In the discomfort of exile, we want to come home. And so, one day, while Laban is away shearing sheep, Jacob and his wives pack up the children and the flock that he had amassed despite Laban's trickery, and they start to head home. Laban, though, overtakes them, and yet Jacob is able to make peace with him. This peace is relatively easy because on the balance, Jacob stands on the moral high ground. Not so with the peace that awaits Esau. Now, as they begin to approach home, Jacob's instinct is to bribe Esau. He sends messengers ahead of him, telling them, when you see Esau, tell him that Jacob has a large flock and will be generous with him. The messengers come back, and they have talked to Esau, and they tell him, Esau's coming to meet you with 400 of his men. Jacob now gets frantic. He starts sending batches of animals, donkeys, sheep, cows, goats, and he instructs the shepherds that take them to tell Esau that these are presents and more are behind them. Perhaps he can buy off Esau's wrath. Maybe Jacob can strike a deal that will save him and his family. Despite the distances and differences of culture and time, doesn't this moment feel a little bit familiar? How often do we try to fix our own messes with the same types of actions that got us into those messes? How often do we try to cover a lie with a lie? How often do we try to cover hurt with hurt? How often do we try to save ourselves, sometimes even to save ourselves from ourselves? The night before this anticipated meeting with Esau, though, Jacob's course changes dramatically. At the ford of the Jabbok, a tributary of the Jordan River, Jacob sends his family ahead, and he spends the night wrestling with God. Jacob emerges with a new name, Israel. He also emerges with a limp. And he says, I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved. Jacob is humbled to realize God's power that can make him limp at a mere touch. Jacob is humbled to realize that God can rename him with but a word. Jacob is humbled to acknowledge that God's power makes his trickery look like a child's game. Jacob's humbled to realize that making things right depends first on God's righteousness and much less on our efforts. The story of Jacob hinges on this encounter. I wonder, have you of late wrestled with God? Have you of late been humbled by an encounter with the Lord? The next day, Jacob limps towards Esau. And whereas the night before he had put his family out first, now he goes ahead of his family, putting them behind him so that he is closer to the danger. When Esau is in sight, Jacob then does something that would have been absolutely unthinkable 20 years before this moment when he had impersonated Esau to steal his blessing. Jacob 7 times humbly bows down to the ground. The tension that has followed these brothers since their conception now reaches its climax. Will Esau and his 400 men surround Jacob and possess him? Will Esau and his 400 men capture Jacob's family and enslave them? Will Esau and his 400 men steal Jacob's flock and leave him with absolutely nothing? will Esau and his 400 men take the life of the one who had taken Esau's blessing? Esau has Jacob exactly where he wants him. And then Esau does the unimaginable. He embraces him. He falls on his neck. He kisses him. And the two brothers weep. We don't hear anything about Esau's journey over the last 20 years. We don't know how much he stewed about Jacob's deception. We don't know how he might have wrestled with God. We don't know what prayers he might have prayed. We don't know what dreams he might have dreamed. We don't know what changed his perspective. But maybe that's the point. Because this story doesn't lead us to the power of forgiving as much as it leads us to the humility of being forgiven. Jacob, Israel, is not the gracious bestower of forgiveness in this story. He is the humble recipient. As Jacob's heirs, as Israel's heirs, as those who by grace have accepted a new covenant with Jesus Christ, we follow in Jacob's footsteps. If we who have sinned and been exiled want to come home, we follow Jacob through the humbling gift of forgiveness. Sometimes forgiveness from other people, sometimes forgiveness from ourselves, always forgiveness from God. Like Jacob, we come home limping. Like Jacob, we come to ourselves when we encounter God. Like Jacob, what makes us remarkable is not our achievements, but a grace which comes like a hug, the grace of the humbling gift of forgiveness. Amen.